Alright, so you all should be muted now. So if you can hear me, can you sort of just give me a thumbs up? Okay, great. Alright, well, it's good to be with you all this morning at Word and Life for our first digital gathering. And we're really, I feel privileged to be with you all, not only during this time and being able to turn this gathering digital, but also to sum up this 10-week study in the book, The Universal Christ, that you all have been studying. So I think what emerged for me when I was preparing for this time was really one central question. What does it mean to see and to act from Christ consciousness? I think this is where Rohr ends up landing the plane as he finishes this book. He does a lot of unpacking what the universal Christ is, what could it mean metaphysically, what could it mean in the Christian tradition, what are the implications of that theologically, but then he turns toward the end to asking, what does it mean to see and act with Christ consciousness? So that's what I want to explore with you all this morning. And again, I think that's really Richard Rohr's point here. He says that the universal Christ is a great theory. It's a nice way to think about the universe. It's actually a benevolent way or a loving way to think about the universe. But this is a quote that he says in that final chapter. He says, unless the Christ mystery rewires you on the physical, neurological, and cellular levels, unless you can actually see and experience that Christ mystery in a new way, this will just remain another theory or ideology. So he really wants to turn practical. And he says that the point of all of this, of the entire book, really, the point is for the Christ mystery to get down into you and to reorder you at every level of your body, your physicality, in a sense. So I want to talk a bit about that this morning. And this morning, just so you know, a little disclaimer here, I don't want to heap more coronavirus news on you this morning. I actually want to give you a bit of a respite from that. But I will say here at the outset that I hope the theory of what I present today, when applied in terms of you developing your own Christ consciousness, that it will relate directly to the state of our world today, to your inner life and to how you connect with the hurting world. So I want to suggest this morning that Christ consciousness is really nothing more than to see the world with the eyes of compassion and to act within the world with the hands of compassion. And this is hopefully bringing Christ consciousness to every moment would be that this is an every moment, a moment-to-moment thing, that we are seeing the world with the eyes of compassion and acting within the world with the hands of compassion. It'd be one thing to follow the thinking of people like Ken Wilber and to say that if you are really enlightened, that is, if you really see from Christ consciousness, that all you will see in the world are Buddhas walking around. You know, you just see glory and light and no suffering. But I think the main critique that usually gets lobbed at Enlightenment thinkers like that is that they don't deal seriously with the real and tangible pain and suffering of the world. And so indeed, if suffering is just an illusion or a product of your body's egoic attachment to the painful situations you're presented with in your life, then so be it. I'm not there yet, you know, in my own journey, and I can own that I'm not as enlightened as somebody like Ken Wilber or Eckhart Tolle. And let me say for a moment that not only are these thinkers likely much more enlightened than I am, but I also appreciate a lot of their contributions to the spiritual journey. Wilber, you know, especially for his integral thought in drawing together the quadrilateral picture for us and spiral dynamics and how he integrates all of that. And Eckhart Tolle especially for presenting what actually I think might be the most constructive or helpful hypothesis for getting, or pedagogy even, for getting present and living in a deeper fullness of Christ consciousness in the moment. So I appreciate these people for that. But so that's not to poo-poo their contributions to the contemplative life and journey. But I want to just mention this morning that my experience has been shaped pretty directly by a journey of suffering. And I remember that deeply. It's really forged a lot of my inquiry into the spiritual life. And some of you know my history with cancer. About 10 years ago, I was diagnosed with cancer as a young man and you know, battled chemotherapy and the whole nine yards there. And but it was really a catalyst in my life for a lot of reflection and more in-depth inquiry into spirituality and theology. And so I remember as I was working on integrating those parts of me that were hurt, I remember having a conversation with one of my professors out in Claremont, whose name is Roland Faber, about some experiences I was having in my contemplative times of feeling really like the picture of reality that he was trying to draw for me in a process, metaphysics, and worldview, and the sheer intensity of the beauty that that he was laying out, for me, it felt like it just had to be too good to be true, given my experience of the world. And I would sit and weep in some of my times over it. It was overwhelmingly iridescent, this picture of reality that he was laying out. And even in the midst of my own suffering, there was something like a divine embrace. That idea, I didn't quite know what to do with that information. You know, that there was something of the divine life that could touch the innermost parts of me that hurt. And I would always ask him questions about that. And so I'll never forget what he said to me, because I wrote it down, and I wrote it down in my phone, and sometimes, you know, digital things tend to stick around these days, so I know I won't forget it. But he said, even if it's too good to be true, even if what you're seeing of reality is too good to be true, then wouldn't that be the state in which you, in the end, could perceive more deeply the reasons of the world's suffering? If you only see beauty and that beauty somehow cuts you off from the world's pain, kind of like in Wilbur's hypothesis that you just see Buddhas walking around, then he said, I don't think that's what Whitehead's philosophy intends, who's my favorite philosopher, who I'll talk about later. But part of the healing process, he said, then would be to bring both sides of beauty and suffering together. And he said, it would not be a healed state without that. If you couldn't figure out a way to bring beauty and suffering together, would not be truly a healed spiritual state. And so I think for me, when he said that, a light bulb really went off. I thought, you know, maybe it's true that we do actually have deep mystical experiences of Christ consciousness. We have these experiences of inner freedom and connection and liberation, and that those experiences of connection with the compassionate divine presence, which in the end is actually who you are at a core level, right? That's your true self and all that. Maybe those experiences of seeing from boundless grace are precisely the places that also see the pain of the world and weep over it and move you toward action to help heal it. Maybe that's one in the same. And there's a paradox, I think, at the heart of the contemplative journey here, because you see, we do, on some level, have to do the detachment work from our egos. We have to detach from our addictions to shame and fear and anxiety and rehashing the past and worrying about the future. And all of that can lead us to a kind of purity of presence, a Christ consciousness in the now. But I think the paradox is this. I think precisely when we detach from those things and are able to include our whole selves in a state of conscious, loving union with reality as it really is, even in its hurt, or what Richard Rohr calls forgiving reality for being what it is. When we do that, I think that's precisely the moment that we are connected back with the world in a compassionate connection. So let me say it simply. Somehow our detachment somehow attaches us. Our detachment attaches us back with the world, but in an entirely new way. Remember, as Rohr said, that when Christ's mystery gets down into you, you start to see and experience the world in an entirely new way. And I love this quote by a liberation theologian named Dorothy Zola. She was a German liberation theologian. And I shared this with our community last night, but it's been really hitting home for me. She said that what mystics often call becoming at one or becoming one is never a possession that cannot be lost. It's not a possession that you can lose or not lose. What really happens in mystical union is not a new vision of God, but a different relationship to the world. One that has borrowed the eyes of God. Isn't that a beautiful picture? I'm gonna read it again. What mystics call becoming at one is never a possession that cannot be lost. What really happens in mystical union is not just this new vision of God, but a different relationship to the world, one that has borrowed the eyes of God. So mystical union is just another word for Christ consciousness, I think. And again, Zella here teaches us that perhaps this union doesn't just give us a new vision of God, but actually gives us the eyes of God to see the world. And so this inner seeing that we have now has a sort of updated software, much like our gathering this morning. You know, we can view the world with divine eyes, in a sense. And this, I think, is what my professor was trying to explain to me when I was asking him about that. That a healed state isn't only seeing beauty. You know, and if that was God, then you know, if we only could see beauty and that's it, then surely God has some explaining or answering to do for the atrocities in this world. But perhaps this mystical shift is really a shift in seeing the world from a different place. Well, I'll add here just for a moment that I really actually do think that this shift is to see the world from the place of beauty. But that's primarily because the best metaphor or image for beauty is a musical one. It's one of harmony. I think beauty is a sort of harmony in the natural order of things. This harmony is always making what Whitehead would call tragic beauty. It's a very Greek idea. That in some sense, the beauty that is, you know, reaped in the world is making harmony, you know, harmony and beauty out of tragedy. And so beauty, true beauty, is not all symphonic, like large-scale orchestral harmony. And although life does have those moments, too, where you drop into that beauty. But as I love philosopher Cornel West says, sometimes it hangs on the blues notes. You know, sometimes it doesn't resolve. Sometimes it is just a little bit more comfortable with the tension, musically even. And I think beauty can see from this place. I think beauty is inherently compassionate because it receives the world's events, whether they be joyous or ecstatic or suffering or atrocious. Beauty really can receive all of them and moves the universe, the song of the universe forward, right? And I encountered this in some of my reading, this quote I want to share with you a bit later. I encountered this a bit later in my studies, after having that conversation with my professor. And this conversation is a conversation between that liberation theologian Dorothy Zella and her then husband at the time, Fulbert Stefanski. And as they were conversing over her recent work, which was called The Silent Cry, I think it came out in the early 2000s, Fulbert reflected on her claims about mysticism and resistance in saying this. And I think this is a really beautiful encapsulation of what I'm trying to communicate this morning. He said, mysticism is the experience of the oneness and the wholeness of life. Therefore, mysticism's perception of life and its vision is also the unrelenting perception of how fragmented life is. Suffering on account of that fragmentation and finding it unbearable is part of that mysticism. Finding God fragmented into rich and poor, top and bottom, sick and well, weak and mighty, that's the mystic suffering. The resistance of St. Francis or Elizabeth of Thuringia or of Martin Luther King's grew out of the perception of beauty. And the long-lasting and most dangerous resistance, and he's talking about mystical resistance, is the one that was born from beauty. Okay. You see, sometimes we have to listen or perhaps have conversations ourselves with the liberation theologians in order to get this other side of things. He's saying beauty is precisely the place where we can perceive the events of the world in their fullness, and where we can move even toward the tragic with loving, conscious union with the reality right in front of us. I think it's really an amazing observation that when you come to know oneness or wholeness, that it also puts you right in touch with the fragmentation and its unbearable dimension of life. Isn't that quite another paradox, you know? That when you encounter wholeness and union, that it puts you right in touch with the fragmentation. Isn't that so true? And this Christ consciousness, I think, is precisely the place where we can move toward a hurting world with compassion. Remember I said earlier that the Christ consciousness is really to see with compassion and to have the act with the hands of compassion. Or what Dorothy Zola calls that we can move toward a hurting world with what she says is constant difficulty, but also with boundless happiness and absolute fearlessness. She says, and this is a Quaker way of thinking about things. She says basically that we can move toward a hurting world with constant difficulty, but with boundless happiness and absolute fearlessness. And isn't it so true that our happiness and our fearlessness are just somehow bound up with the constant difficulties of life? And you don't get to pick and choose one or the other. She claims that yes, you can do this. You don't have to get washed away in your fears of this constant difficulty that we endure. But although many people do get washed away in our fears, we don't have to deny or repress our sadness and pretending to be boundlessly happy and fearless all the time. But we have to find a way, if you aren't hearing me yet this morning, to bring them all together, to bring them all together in one perspective. It's a non-dual perspective. So how can a human being even do this is really the question, I think, this morning. I love that James Finley recalls this story about Thomas Merton when he was once asked about going away to the monastery to be cloistered off from the world. And he said that Merton said, "We didn't come to the monastery to breathe some rarefied air free from the suffering of the world, but we came here to learn how to bear the suffering of the whole entire world in our hearts." We didn't go to the monastery to breathe rarefied air free from suffering. We came to learn the interior pedagogy of what it means to bear the suffering of the whole world in our hearts. And I just think that's a beautiful invitation, but it's much easier said than done, right, Merton? Thanks for that. You know? And so when Finley unpacks this idea, I think he comes up with this just, you know, beautiful theology of what it means to meet Christ consciousness in the midst of a suffering world. He says, you know, if you draw a trajectory like this, and along that trajectory you are doing your best to relieve yourself and others from suffering, which he says is a moral imperative, we all need to be doing our best to relieve ourselves and others from suffering, that the moment on that trajectory where you realize that you can't actually relieve your own suffering, God is the infinity of that. God is the infinity of that inability. And so he says that the Christ then is the infinite presence of God in the most interior places that hurt, in those deep places of need, of liberation from suffering. He says that this is surrender. This is the mystical moment of surrender. This is the consolidation of a new kind of consciousness getting down into your physiology. You know, and he goes further to say that this doesn't then remove you from the human situation. You know, if you have this moment of surrender and mystical union, that now you get to leave suffering behind. I mean, if you think about it, Jesus is sweating blood, right, the night before he goes to the cross. It's not that you get to all of a sudden, again, be this enlightened person that's out of a body necessarily. But what it does is it puts you in touch, he says, Finley says, with the incomprehensible stature of the human situation. He says it puts you in touch with the incomprehensible stature or status of the human situation. He says there's something unbearably beautiful unfolding everywhere, and the root source of our sorrow is that we've lost this experiential access to the one thing that sets us free. says there's only one thing going on here. There's nothing missing anywhere. Everything is somehow the unmanifest mystery of love made manifest, and everything in the world, including you and me and rocks and birds and trees and oceans and stars and galaxies, everything is somehow revealing the very mystery that we seek, that it is the unmanifest mystery of love made real. Okay. Again, it's a beautiful vision, right? It's a beautiful vision. But how could something like this be said in a hurting world? I think the answer is precisely that we need to see with the very eyes of God in order to see it. Which our word for that is Christ consciousness that we're coming back to. Other traditions use other words to describe this kind of seeing, but Christ consciousness is the one that Rohr uses and the one that we're going to use this morning. And so if there's nothing missing anywhere, Finley, really? In a world that with an ensuing pandemic? No, there's nothing missing anywhere. There's an unbearable beauty unfolding everywhere in a world where thousands or perhaps millions might die from a rogue virus? Yes, it's all an unbearable beauty. How can we say these kinds of things? There's a part of me, I think, just to be honest with you all, that wants to rage against claims like this. There's a hurt part of me that is not yet surrendered to these truths. I think on some level, if we're still human and at the bodily level at all, we know that feeling, like the tension between making a claim like that and the realities that we face every day. And you know, I think it's a human, and I think as a human being, or all of us as human beings, thrown into this life without any choice and having to somehow make sense of it, that there's a truth to that, a truth that perhaps God already knows, but maybe I need to hear again in expressing my grief over that. And yet, I have to say, I'm still extremely compelled by this loving vision and naming of reality. There's something about love, there's something about beauty that calls us. And in fact, the etymology for beauty is, you know, a call. It's being called. There's a call. And so much of my own, like I said earlier at the outset, much of my own theological and philosophical and contemplative journey has been to find a way to allow love to be the name and frame, and to allow beauty to be real and efficacious, and for peace to rule in our hearts and our world. Especially, you know, I think we all go on this journey on some level. I think peace is what we all want, and it's sometimes the most difficult thing to find. As I mentioned, my favorite philosopher, Alfred North Whitehead, has courageously offered up this statement that defines the evasive notion of peace in stating this. He says, "Peace is primarily a trust in the efficacy of beauty." I'm going to say that again. Peace is primarily a trust in the efficacy of beauty. And then he goes on to say, "The trust in the self-justification of beauty introduces faith where reason fails to reveal the details." The trust in the self-justification of beauty introduces faith where reason fails to reveal the details. Now, you need to know that who is saying this is one of the most rationally and empirically minded philosophers of the 20th century. But what he's saying is beauty invites us into a different register. It's one that it is only really known by faith. And so it's only then, with love as our jumping off point, as our name for reality, that we can come to see clearly the path laid out for us toward peace through beauty. And unsurprisingly for many of us, those of us who have journeyed in the Christian tradition or in another religious tradition for a long time, that the path is one of faith, of trust, of trusting in the efficacy of beauty, of saying, yes, I think beauty is actually real, and the love that I've experienced in my life is somehow revelatory of something true. And let me say to you as plainly as I can, I think when we decide to love the world, or perhaps to love our lives, and when we peer out at reality from the eyes of beauty, indeed, I think the very eyes of God, in the midst of a hurting world, I think we are seeing with Christ consciousness. And the yield of this kind of conscious seeing is peace. Now, again, how can we make claims like that? This is not a denial of the suffering of the world. This is not eyes that are looking away from the pain and hurt, both within our own lives and the lives of our others and our loved ones and in humanity. I think it's precisely the divine nature down in there that is a manifold of harmony, that is making love from fear and beauty from ashes and peace from war. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think this is that place within us that we all long to be seeing from all the time. And it's just that our journeys are these winding paths of surrender to be in that place. You know, what Finley calls assuming the inner stance of least resistance, to be there, to be really there. Because it's always really there. But the difficulty for us is, how do we become more conscious of it? How do we have that Christ consciousness increasingly consolidate over the trajectory of our life's arc, you know? And so this is what I would call attuning to something like a mystagogy of becoming, or a mystagogy of process. And a mystagogy is just, you know, it's kind of a nerdy word, but it's a way to say that there's a pedagogy of mystery that we're all entered into, you know, this life and what it is, that we're students of the mystery, and that mystery will, if once we open to it, will set us on a path of infinite becoming, of infinite depth, infinite growth, infinite surrender into infinite love. And this, I think, is getting put in touch on some level with what Richard Rohr calls the Christ mystery, which is a non-dual, infinite beauty that is becoming, and that we have an opportunity and indeed an invitation to see and live from. And so he illustrates it this way in the chapter on resurrection. He says, incarnation is already redemption, Christmas is already Easter, and Jesus is already Christ. Incarnation is already redemption, Christmas is already Easter, and Jesus is already Christ. Already one. They're all already one, brought together in some kind of mystical marriage. And I love John O'Donohue says, you know, maybe God is that place where perhaps dawn and twilight are one. Maybe God is that place where perhaps dawn and twilight are one. And so this is the vision held out before us, that there is an interior place, that there is a place of harmonic beauty that is not somehow devoid of suffering or somehow, you know, turning its eyes away from the world, but actually in our detachment from our ego, which wants to pull us away from that truth and separate things out and chop things up and create dualisms. Instead of that, when we detach from that ego and we decide to choose to take the path inward, that path of detaching from ego attaches us compassionately back to the world. And so Rohr encourages us in the last chapter of the Universal Christ that he says, this can't remain just theory, but he says, we must practically rewire our responses. We must find a form of prayer that actually invades our unconscious, or nothing will change at any depth. Nothing will change at any depth. And this beautiful theory that I'm trying to lay out this morning of Christ consciousness has to find a practice. It has to find its ground in you. It has to get down into that unconscious place. Otherwise, nothing really changes. We still will see with eyes that judge, eyes that want to chop things up into good and bad, black and white. And so it has to find its ground in us. And I know that many of you are familiar with the practice of centering prayer. It's a practice that's been around for a long while, and I'm sure you're familiar with Father Keating's work on that, as well as Cynthia Bourgeau's. But for me, I think that this is one practice that is just an example or an illustration of what it means to daily move toward that place of Christ consciousness. And so, you know, a couple of things that Bourgeau mentions that gives us this fuller picture of how it rewires us is really this. She says that, and this is going to get a little technical because she's a PhD and uses some neuroscience language, but just bear with me for a moment. She says, whatever non-dual may look like when approached through the spiritual filters classically used to describe it, neurologically, the capacity to perceive reality in this way, meaning this non-dual way, this place of Christ consciousness, depends on a new way of organizing one's perceptual field. It's an upgrade in the operating system, if you will. Basically, the essence of the non-dual is a quantitative change. Again, not qualitative, but a quantitative change, not in the object of one's perception, meaning that thing out there that we relate to, but in the mechanics of perception itself. So the quantitative change is something that happens inside of you in the way that you see. Remember Zola's encouragement too, that mystical union means you see from the eyes of God. It doesn't just change your view of God, but it connects you with the world and you see with the eyes of God. And that this is a quantitative shift that actually happens in our biology. And so she says, rather than perception through differentiation, right? This is the programming that we have in our minds. It helps us grow up. It helps us move through the world. It helps us individuate, you know, and make sense of our world. She says, instead of that, one begins through the practice of centering prayer to perceive through what she calls holographic resonance, which is really what she says is the capacity to sense the whole pattern as a single unified field. And of course, then she says one sees from wholeness, right? So rather than seeing from the mind that is fragmented, that needs to judge things in order to make sense in them, through the practice of centering prayer, which is a silent practice of detachment and descent into detachment, descent, and consent to the divine presence within you, that what ends up happening when you do this over and over and over and over, over years of your life, is that we don't any longer perceive through differentiation, but we perceive through a unified field. We start to see the interconnections. And if you've been on a contemplative journey for any amount of years, which I know many of you have, you know this difference that starts to take place. Somewhere along your practice, whatever it is, it doesn't have to be centering prayer, you start to go, hey, I think I'm starting to see and experience the world from a different place. And so I just wanted to name, as we talk about this practice of centering prayer, that it's really this physical change that happens. And it doesn't happen magically the first time you sit silent for 20 minutes. That's not how it works. But the more and more that you learn to let go of your thought stream that, is that part of your brain that wants to chop things up and get you back caught up in a story about your life or a worry about the future, that the more you practice that, the more you will start to experience a oneness. It'll deepen within you. And then you'll have this longing for that place within you, a longing to return to that, a longing to go back to the well in that sense. And so Bourgeot, I think, offers us this invitation to see that it really is possible to look upon the world from a non-dual vantage point and still affirm the reality of change. Remember, we talked about how could we sit in love and beauty and peace in a world that is full of suffering, in a world that's full of tragedy and atrocity. How could we be non-dual and non-judgmental about the hurt and the suffering of the world? And how could we sit in this place and affirm the reality of change and movement and structures in which Bourgeot says the formless so marvelously drapes itself? And what she says is one simply sees them from the perspective of oneness. There's no implicit need to reduce the many to a primal unity in order to lay claim to that. But what she says is that we see from oneness. And again, with Zola and others, we see that oneness, that wholeness, actually helps us see fragmentation. Like I inquired of my professor, that beauty, that attunement to beauty, gives us reason also to see the causes of suffering in the world. So this healed state, this Christ consciousness, again, that can be cultivated through practices, is really that place that is wholeness. It is love. It is beauty. It is peacemaking. It is whole making. But it's just that we are in a human situation that is connected to a world that's full of those opposites, fear and war and tragedy. And so if we are to be a people who take Richard Rohr's book, The Universal Christ, seriously, and we want to be people who cultivate a sense of Christ consciousness, which again is a compassion for our situation and for the world's situation, then we have to realize that when you go to that place, it's not just liberation from your own fears and injustices and pains and sorrows, but it, will put you in connection with the world too. And that I think that the icon of this is Jesus. The icon of this is the path of Christ that we follow. In order to be one who, you know, liberates the captives, heals the sick, you know, teaches and touches the world in its need, right? And Cynthia Bourgeot goes on to say that when you sit in meditation, when you find your practice or whatever it might be that helps you cultivate that, you are actually presenting yourself as an icon of one of the most archetypal and noble human activities, communion with the infinite. You see, especially in, Luke's gospel, Jesus sort of has this, if you read through just the chapter by chapter, he has this tendency to go away and pray during the night, all night, right? And then he comes back to meet a hurting world. And then he goes away again. He's like, I'm going up on the hill, y'all, and I'll be back, you know? So what Jesus seems to be doing in those instances is presenting himself as an icon of communion with the infinite, his relationship with what he called Abba, Daddy. You know, which is not a, that's not an image of masculinity so much as it is, a connotation of a parental figure, right? Mommy is the, same thing. The divine feminine is, welcome there too. And so Bourgeot says that we need to be aware of the natural dignity and beauty of this archetype, and how it will help our own body find its place more easily. And it will also be of substantial help to everybody else when we meditate in a group. So what she's saying is, when we find a practice like centering prayer, which I'm going to invite us to practice just about 5 minutes of in silence together toward the end of this, before we turn to our questions. When we find a practice, we realize that prioritizing moments in our days where we are wanting to connect with the infinite or commune with the infinite in this way, that what we're doing is presenting ourselves as icons of love, as houses of the mystery, as, you know, beacons of the sacred. And when we do that, it will change us. It will change us. It won't just change us spiritually. It won't just awaken us and enliven us. It will change us neurobiologically. Our relationship with the world around us will become more connected, because we are more connected with the divine. And so I just invite you to consider for yourself today, if you want to prioritize cultivating deeper Christ consciousness, again, which is just seeing with the eyes of compassion, having what Merton said, the ability to bear the entire suffering of the world in your heart, which, by the way, I just, as a quick aside, we can't do unless it's the divine in us doing it. Because when we get into that place of union, we disappear and God appears, and God disappears and we appear. And that's supposed to sound confusing, because it's the same thing, right? How could we bear that without the divine presence being the place within us, the true self, being the place within us that can connect compassionately with that? So if you want to be in that place, if you want to develop that, I just encourage you to think about a practice in your life that you have encountered at one point where a little spark went off in your heart or mind that said, you know, I wish I had more time to do more of that. I wish there, you know, I wish I had more time to go for that walk. I wish I had more time to sit and pray in centering prayer. I wish I had more time for silence and solitude. I wish I had more time to go have enriching conversation over a meal with beloveds, right? So think back to a place in your life where you felt that spark go off of, wow, I really felt deepened, and I just wish I had more time to do that. And try to name that for yourself, and then come into a place where you welcome that practice as a way for you to deepen Christ consciousness. Because we need more compassionate people in the world. And that compassion is an outflow of our connection with divine compassion within. And so I want to leave us this morning with a quote by one of my favorite philosophers and spiritual writers, John O'Donohue. If you've heard me speak at Word and Life before, I probably quoted something from him every time. But I think that, again, these words sort of bring home for me what is happening in the contemplative journey, and especially how beauty and death, he calls it death in this passage, but it's really suffering, little deaths, you know, losses, griefs, tragedies. And he's really pointing out here how beauty is in a constant conversation with suffering. And I think that this sort of illustrates for me that non-dual center that we all have, that we can invite and practice our way into, where we hit that place within us where, you know, as Rohr said, you know, incarnation is already redemption. Christmas is already Easter. Jesus is already Christ. You are already Christ in that sense. And I just leave this as a sort of hanging meditation for us. And then I've got my singing bowl here, and I'm just going to invite us to practice 5 minutes of quiet. And then I'll ring us out as well. And then when I ring us out, we can come to some Q&R together. And so if you don't know the practice of centering prayer, let me give you a quick invitation. Practice of centering prayer is basically choosing a sacred word or phrase. It could be one word, two words, a little phrase. The goal is not to repeat it over and over. It's not a repetition prayer, but it is a way for you to say, the intent of this is to detach from my head and my thoughts and to descend into my heart and my presence. And anytime I find myself that's desiring to descend into my heart and my presence, getting caught up in my thoughts, I repeat that sacred word or phrase in order to call myself back to a silent center. Okay, so that's really the practice of centering prayer. And the heart is to be a heart of consent to the divine activity within you. And many of us might find ourselves just fighting for 5 minutes, right, with our brains and the worries and anxieties. I want to say that's okay. That's okay if you feel like that, if you're fighting in that way. But the goal, again, is to just practice for a few moments becoming an icon of infinite communion. So I'm going to read this O'Donohue quote, and then I'll get my singing bowl, and I'll ring us in, and we'll have about 5 minutes of silence. And then I'll ring us out, and then we'll come into some Q&R together. So this should put us right at about 11 o'clock. So O'Donohue says this: within a culture, the contemplatives are the ones who probe the death event. The subtext of the contemplative life is a creative companionship with one's own death. All fear is rooted in the fear of death. The contemplative strives for a depth resonance, a depth recognition at the outer and inner extreme where death and transience and eternity issue from God. Maybe life and death are one in God. The contemplative wishes instinctively to reach the absolute source, the spring of essence, the well of origin. In this circle, all is one and nothing is broken. The crevice that brings in duality and opposition and otherness has not yet opened. It is to this numinous region that the contemplative mind is drawn. It is beauty that magnetizes the contemplative, and is the duty of the contemplative to give beauty away so that the rest of the world may, in the midst of squalor, in the midst of ugliness, and in the midst of pain, remember that beauty is possible. If death had the final word, then beauty would be reduced to a transient and indeed a ghostly presence. But the heroism of the contemplative endeavor is to attempt to reach through to that final threshold and enter that fierce conversation between death and beauty. The irony is that death brings out the fire and fiber at the heart of beauty. Within this white shadow, the gentle eyes of beauty can outstare the unraveling eyes of death. Below the vicissitudes and vagaries of loss and transience is the primal affection, which is love, the divine beauty which holds everything together. In that embrace, memory is always new possibility, and all possibility comes finally home to memory. Ultimately, the contemplative journey discloses that there is no need to be afraid of death. And when the heart finds its contemplative radiance, the darkness of death shall have no dominion. The beauty of God is that sure embrace where eternal life is eternal memory. Let's turn to centering prayer.
Yes, right on time and left on Dawson, I think. What's happening?
Hello. We're unmuted.
All right. That you are. Everybody is back. So I hope that you all could hear me.
What happened? Was it plastic wave?
I'm assuming that you could.
I could hear you.
Right. Okay.
Tim?
Yes?
I have a question. And could you share that quote with Judith to send out, the O'Donohue one you just read, with all of us?
You know what I'll do is I'll paste it in the chat right now for you.
Perfect. And then my second question is, are you doing a similar thing with the Way Collective? Are you going to be posting talk?
Can you repeat that last thing you said? Or am
sure.
I posting talks?
Are you going to be posting any of your talks or doing any kind of Zoom calls with the Way Collective so we can, that we might be able to access to get some of your support and wisdom and thoughts about going forward?
Yeah, I think the easiest way for you all to stay in touch with that is that I'm sending out two or three emails a week that we're calling Hope Next or Hope Together, and it's going to have a lot of resources in there. It's not directly my teaching, but it's usually a conglomeration of a lot of wise people's thought.
Sure. So,
yeah, go ahead.
There's a way to go on that site and give an email so we can be on your e-blast list.
That's right. If you go to the way, just go to waycollective.org. You can just scroll down to the bottom of the homepage and there's an email sign up form there.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah, no problem.
And Tim did have a dialogue talk last night digitally that everyone could have gone into, and I think you're going to be doing that every Wednesday?
Yes, it's just our usual Wednesday night gatherings translated over to digital format. So every Wednesday night at 6:15, our community is going to get together to do what we do, which is usually pause for some contemplation, you know, have some teaching and conversation time. During that, we actually do breakout session groups, so I can split all of you all up into groups of four or five, and you have your own conversation, then we come back. So we do all that on Wednesday nights.
He's been doing a series on liberation theology, so I hope that that'll be on his website.
Yeah, and I've pasted that quote into the chat if anybody wants to go grab it and copy and paste it into their own.
That's supposed to show up on the screen?
Only if you click that button down there on the bottom of your screen that says chat. Oh.
Chat, okay. Oh, yeah.
Or at the top.
There it is.
So this is just a time for a question and response. If anybody has anything that they're carrying in their hearts and minds, and I invite you to just start speaking. And if for some reason nobody's acting like they can hear you, it might be that you're still muted. So check that out.
Tim?
Yes.
I was intrigued by your frequent allusion to beauty. Beauty, you know, there's these little wise old things that we carry around with us. One of them is like this one. Beauty is in the eyes of the beholder. And I didn't think that was a particularly profound observation, but now when I listen to what you're saying, I'm thinking, what about that? Is beauty in the eyes of the beholder, or is there anything more objective?
That's a wonderful question. I think it's a very philosophical question, which I am happy to answer because that's primarily where my work is in philosophy. So I think that really is a result of Descartes and Kant's line of thinking, which was to separate beauty from reality, from being an intrinsic property in reality. So, you know, Hans Urs von Balthasar said that beauty was the one thing about which the world needs to understand itself. And so what that means is classically beauty was baked into the whole thing. You know, that beauty was somehow, you know, part of the natural order. And that what happened in the Enlightenment was that we made it in the eye of the beholder in such a way that there's no more natural or intrinsic beauty. It's only a phenomenon of our minds. It's my opinion versus yours. What I think is beautiful is really beautiful to me, and it doesn't have to be what's beautiful to you. And what I'm talking about is really back, you know, bringing us back to beauty being a natural quality of the universe itself, of which obviously we're a part and everything's a part. So for me, that whole line of thinking that puts beauty in the eye of beholder has done us a really bad, a big disservice. In fact, you know, one thinker whose name is Sandra Lubarsky, she says that when this happened philosophically, when beauty became in the eye of the beholder rather than natural in the world, that we moved from beauty as a cosmological reality to a cosmetological reality. So it moves from being the order of the universe to how you reorder your face, right? And that was a really sad move that we made as a society. So for me, I would just, you know, offer up that I think beauty is actually a part of everything, a part of every event or moment in the history of the universe, and it's something that we can attune to and see, you know. So.
Well, I can try that on for size. Let me mention one more thing that I heard you mention, which is something about music getting to the point, it's virtually, if you get to music, musical.
Mm-hmm. And what?
No, that's your background philosophy. My background is musicology. And I always am aware when I deal with music that there is consonance, but there is dissonance. And without any dissonance, the consonance is meaningless.
Right. Yes, yes, yes to that whole image. I love it.
Yeah. It doesn't mean that I don't, you know, shrink at the sound of a bandsaw or something like that, but there is music needs moments of dissonance and resolution. It's a big metaphor.
I can, just slightly, yes.
Kim, I have a question.
Okay.
Would it be possible to put us into small groups now for about 15 minutes, about 3 or 4 per group for conversation?
It would be if you all would like to do that. So I don't know how to take a raise of hands, you know, on this, but would that benefit you all to do that? We could.
Yes, please.
Let's try it, Tim.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Then what I'm going to do is hit a button that is going to split all of the participants in this whole video room into small groups of 3 or 4. And when I do that, you'll see something pop up and you just sort of accept it. And then after 15 minutes, which will put us at 11:25. I'll hit another button that's going to bring us all back into this room, and you just accept the invitation to come back. So it's pretty easy, and it'll happen naturally. But it will mean that, you know, that you'll be in a room with 3 people who you'll be randomly assigned to. So we got to trust the algorithm on this one, and remember to be compassionate. Speak for statements. And then we'll come back at 11:25. So
do we have to do anything on our end?
You'll have to just accept. You'll see something pop up that says accept, basically.
Okay.
And then it will do its own doing that. So, all right. Okay, here we go. It's going to happen automatically. You all just accept it. And then at 11:25, I'll hit a button and it'll invite us all back. Okay.
Okay. I don't see where. Okay.
Join.
Join the breakout room.
You got it. Hey, Gregory?
I'm just testing out the system a little.
Cool.
Yeah, I think I got the link on Facebook or something to this.
On your Facebook, pictures like Grumpy Cat.
Oh, great. That's cool.
I saw it on Tuesday.
Were you here for the first part of it?
Well, I was.
I wanted to change it, but then I remembered it'd probably be hard for me to get used to not looking for a brown N when I'm in tech class.
Is that somebody at your house speaking?
So, I just have.
Gregor, were you here for the beginning of it or no?
Yeah, I was here like about 5 minutes. After it started.
Great. Okay.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool software, huh?
I know. My, you know, I go to a Unity in Santa Barbara, a Unity community.
Yeah.
And this is something we really want to try to pick up. And so that's why I turned on my microphone and video to see how this works. Because we had our first Sunday without connecting to people, except people could watch the service.
Right.
And I think this is great to have this exchange, especially the breakout thing that you guys did, you know, like 10 minutes ago. Mm-hmm. I was actually in that group, but my microphone was muted and my video was off. But then when I went to settings, it disconnected me. I was with the couple, the older couple, and there was three of us in a group, and I was muted in the, So that's the thing. I have to tell people to turn that on to start, I guess.
Yeah. No, totally. Yeah, it's great. We've been using it for our community here called the Way Collective. And we did our first one last night, and it worked out really well. So.
Good.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Great. Well, thanks for your thanks for listening, and it was really deep. So I love it. I love the deepness, and I was just trying to connect it to all my past knowledge that I'm going through. I do a lot of Well, thanks for your help. As you can tell, I'm relaxing, but I thought I'd check out the Tim. All right, well, I'll try to keep connected. Is there a links on here to
Word and Life?
Yeah, or I can just look it up.
I would look it up. Yeah, Google it. Word and Life, and then I don't know what they're going to be doing in terms of their gatherings, but. We do some on Wednesday nights, too. So,
okay.
I'm actually going to watch. You can see this, but I'm going to close all their breakout rooms right now and have them all come back in. So, you'll see what happens. I'm going to close them.
Okay.
And they should start to pop back in here slowly but surely if they get it.
Hey, Joe. So I think we're back on the main, main thing.
Hey, there's Kathy.
Yep.
Goodbye to break room three.
Yeah, we're back. Oh, this is so wonderful, Judith.
Yeah, it was awesome.
Yeah, we're gonna have to talk after.
Thank
about
you to Mary Beth for suggesting it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you to Tim for doing it.
Tim for making it happen.
It's so nice to see everyone, isn't it?
Yes.
Thank you.
Hey.
I'm nowhere in my garage now, hiding out from my family.
That was great, Tim. That worked out well.
Really amazing.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad to hear that.
Tim, do you have the hunt? Plan.
Hey, I lost you there for a second. Was that you, Catherine, who's speaking?
Which program on Zoom do you have if I wanted to get this so we could do it for Word and Life?
You know, I don't know. I think it's just the regular plan. I didn't look to see.
Okay. All right. There's 100 and there's 3. I can research it. No problem.
Oh, yeah.
I just was waiting for people to come back.
I think I just have the Pro, probably.
Okay, thank you. That's great.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Tim, did I see that there were like 35, 36 people that were tuned in?
Yeah.
Yes. That's not counting two in one picture.
Yeah.
They're doubling down.
And that's even more.
Looks like they're staying at home together.
I don't know. I see like four. I see 16 little. Screens.
Mm. Like some people have left, Tom, and they're down to 23 now, but there were 35.
Yeah.
There were 35 squares.
Yeah.
It has 35 squares. Right.
A lot of them are silent and mute and invisible.
Yeah. I can't get my picture. I don't know how to. I think my camera's broken.
So, should we move to the Q&A part, Tim, or?
Yeah, no, I figured that's what you all wanted to do, but we can do whatever you all want, to be honest.
Think presentation.
I think we can all second
that. Yay. Yay, Tim.
I lost you all for a second, so if one person could try to speak at a time, I could maybe try to make out what the question is.
No one.
Can I offer a comment on a previous question?
Sure.
Was there a question that I missed? I might have just missed a question if somebody asked one.
I'm just back again to mention that on the subject of beauty, there's a Shakespeare sonnet. It's called Sonnet 65. And it's all about how the struggle between beauty and all the other stuff in the world.
Yeah.
May play into what we're talking about theologically or philosophically. I don't know. On a 64.
We'll have to check that out, Tom.
Yeah, sure.
I just have a comment, question, sure. Response, whatever. I think as things progress, as they will in this time, I think that, do you see that our call to find the beauty, the inward beauty and oneness beauty that you so eloquently described, but also the beauty around us, the open heart of gratitude and seeing the beauty amidst what we might be seeing happening in our communities and in our world more up close and front row. Any comment about that, Tim?
Did you say that last portion just one more time? You cut out there for a sec.
I'm just wondering about any comment about the ability for us to see both beauty inward, the Christ consciousness type of beauty that you describe,
yeah,
as well as things may not look so beautiful in the circumstantial world coming. Any comment? Can you speak to that? Just what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I can. So for me, I think one thing that needs to be said that perhaps maybe I didn't explain more fully is that beauty as a harmony is always making beauty from the ashes or even the suffering or the tragic elements in life. So that's why one could say something like God is beauty, but one could also say something like the divine nature is compassion. Because harmony is sort of this compassionate commitment to the music of the world that is always through sometimes atonality, sometimes symphonic harmony, committed to the world in that sense, in such a way that it is compassionately feeling the feelings of the world. So for me, if we were to say, like during this time of pandemic, that we need to embrace beauty and just look for the silver lining, I think that would be an impoverished, not only sense of beauty, but it would be an impoverished call to people who are going to be dealing with real death and real suffering in very real ways. And so for me, what it basically is, I think on some level, is a fidelity to the world. It's a call to be compassionately connected to the world, knowing that, yes, even this pandemic will have beauty that will blossom on the other side of it, but that's not to dismiss that part of the compassionate and beautiful relationship to the world is to honor its suffering, is to grieve well, is to be helpers with each other, because that is an echo of the divine reality, which is that creative presence that is committed to this universe continuing to move it forward as we go. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's kind of how I
understand it. Yeah.
Kim, I do want to come back to you were talking about harmony and music, and you had that wonderful Cornel West quote. Could you speak a little bit more about this whole concept musically? Because it gives me something to put my head around.
Right.
Otherwise, it starts to feel rather theoretical.
Yeah. Yeah, so so Cornel West was, in that quote, really critiquing the romanticism of the Enlightenment, that the project, the philosophical or theological project was just to find a way to say that wholeness is behind everything. And what he said was, I'm a blues man. He's like, you can't tell me that symphonic sort of like harmony is behind everything, because what's the blues then? You know, the blues doesn't resolve ever. It doesn't resolve. So he was using that musical image to say that if you tell somebody like McCoy Tyner or a blues pianist that they need to resolve the blues, like they would look at you quite oddly. And that what we realize that is that the blues is too a kind of music, and that it's just as much a music as one of Beethoven's symphonies, you know. And in fact, Cornel West goes even further to say that Beethoven said on his deathbed that he had found a way, even he started to communicate it through his later string quartets and things like that, that Beethoven had found a way to love the world in all of its, you know, tumult, in all of its disarray. And so what I guess what I would try to say with that is, I think if we're going to talk about wholeness or talk about beauty at all, or talk about this love that is a part of everything, it has to include the blues, and it has to include the symphonies, and that it's all music. And that's a way to say that, like, that's what the blues are really doing in a sense, is taking suffering. It's coming out of a time, you know, where there were people who were enslaved, and they are starting to allow what's down in their bones to come out through the tonality of the music. And I think that they're making beauty, you know, in a sense. But it's not a beauty that resolves everything, you know. It's a beauty that's committed to the beauty making, in a sense. It's a beauty that's committed to the improvisation of being in a trio or a quartet of people playing and not resolving, you know? And so what else is the universe? I mean, it's going to keep doing that for seemingly infinite periods of time. So for me, yeah, it's important to hold those two things together and not to say that the blues is a form of harmonic beauty, and not to say that the harmonic beauty is a form of the blues, you know, but in a sense to say that all of it is beautiful, and that it is a way to make music with the reality of our existence in the world. And then on some level, I love that as a poetic image of our lives. Sometimes we're playing the blues, sometimes we're listening to the symphonies, and they can both hit us and strike us as sacred and as comforting in different periods, you know?
Tim?
Yeah.
Could I piggyback? I first want to thank you. Such a beautiful voice this morning.
Oh,
it's been an incredible morning, so thank you. And I wanted to kind of dovetail on this notion of the unresolved nature of the blues on a personal level. Certainly with the pandemic, we don't know where it's going to head. But on a personal level, I have a situation where I know it's going to head. We're sitting with a family member, my daughter-in-law, who's in the process of dying from a brain tumor. And it's incredibly painful. And out of that has been depths of beauty and suffering. And this began in December, and I happen to be back east with Cynthia for a workshop, wisdom school workshop, and was held in such beauty and grace with her. And at one point, she did have a beautiful meditation, a healing meditation for my soul with the group one night. And I told her that I kept thinking of the verse of Julian of Norwich, and all shall be well, all manner of things shall be well. And she looked me in the eye and she said, no. She said, all shall be. And it struck me so deeply, not all shall be well,
yes,
but all shall be. Yes. And in the midst of this suffering that my family's going through, I am seeing such depth of beauty watching my son with his beloved. And the doctors that are coming to me, they've not seen such devotion, such love, and such caring. He's kept her alive. He has lupus and a brain tumor. And I'm just in awe of this beauty that is around in the suffering. So when I think about all shall be well, I really reframe my verse into all shall be. And in the midst of that, there is suffering, but in that beauty, it gives wholeness. So thank you. I just wanted to share that personal note.
Thank you, Marianne. I appreciate your vulnerability in doing that, but I think it was a gift to everybody here. So sorry to hear about what your family's going through, and yeah, there's these things in life that just don't seem to resolve, don't seem to make any sense. And I love that idea that all shall be, you know, and all is being or becoming. All is becoming, all shall be, and all manner of things shall be what they are.
Can I mention something musical again? You were talking about.
Go for it.
All right. I recommend that if you really want to know what it means to have music be mirror the unresolved, you need to listen to Charles Ives' The Unanswered Question. You can probably pick it up on YouTube. Charles Ives is the American composer.
Okay.
And it's called The Unanswered Question. And it speaks for itself. I won't say anymore.
I wrote it down. We'll do that.
It's remarkable.
You know, one thing I forgot to mention today, just along that theme, is I love that, you know, James Finley, when he talks about this journey into beauty, or the journey into Christ consciousness, he says, you start off the contemplative journey by thinking that you're the one asking all the questions and trying to get them answered. But what you realize as you head deeper into the contemplative journey is that I don't even think I know the question, let alone, but that I'm actually probably not even the one asking the question. And that it's God who's asking the question. And now I'm at a point where I don't even know what the question is. So I thought that was interesting as you brought up this idea of the unanswered question, you know, being a musical piece. It's that way, I think, of entering into the Christ mystery, that we come in thinking that we're going to get all our questions answered, get this all straight so that we can be finally at rest. And we end up being opened up to this mystery that we don't even know what the question is being posed of in us anymore. And so we're just trying to be open and take that inner posture of least resistance to the questioner, in a sense.
Right. You know, Tim, sometimes there's music that throws us I'm going to quote to you a lyric from Porgy and Bess. It ain't necessarily so. It ain't necessarily so. The things that you're liable to read in the Bible, they ain't necessarily so. You know that already.
Tim, can you hear me?
Yeah, is that Alice?
Yeah. I loved what you were saying about centering prayer and what happens in centering prayer, the practice of it, which is it's an affirmation to my own experience for 35 years maybe of what I call silence. For me, silence is a presence, and it's like the conversation between Jesus and Nicodemus about being born again, and Nicodemus saying, how can I climb back in my mother's womb? And it's about spiritual rebirth. But for me, silence is that womb, and that womb is what you're talking about, the wholeness, the beauty, balance, the harmony. And if we can climb back in, present on every level that you're talking about, neurologically, even physically, and when we, as we progress, as I progress with that, it's given me a capacity to really see from the whole, and have a greater amount of suffering that's in the world, but also a greater trust in the way it flows. So I think those are all fruits of the practice over the time of centering prayer. Anyhow, thank you.
No, thank you. I think that's a beautiful attestation, and seems to be really resonant with what I was trying to present. And it reminds me that, again, that center, that place that you're talking about as a unified field does not mean that wholeness somehow precludes suffering, but it somehow includes suffering. And I love, you reminded me of this Annie Dillard quote that I really like that I'll read for you all. And she kind of talks about how that journey down in there to that place you're talking about, what the nature of it is. She says, "In the deeps are the violence and terror of which psychology has warned us. But if you ride these monsters deeper down, if you drop with them farther over the world's rim, you find what our sciences cannot locate or name, the substrate, the ocean or matrix of, or ether, which buoys the rest, which gives goodness its power for good and evil its power for evil, the unified field, our complex and inexplicable caring for each other and for our life together here. This is given, it is not learned."
Wow. Beautiful. That's absolutely right.
Oh, wow.
Who's saying, oh, wow, I agree, but I just wonder who's saying that.
I am.
Isn't that amazing?
Oh, my. Could we get that? Could you put that in writing somewhere?
I'll paste that, too, right now.
Send it to me, and I can get it on the website of Word and Life.
Okay. I'll paste it in the chat, too, right now, just so you all can copy it from there and paste it.
Paste it in what? In the chat?
In the chat.
Experience before.
Can anybody hear me?
I think I like Tom's idea. An old-fashioned email.
That's also easy. I can do that.
Okay.
Jackie, are you trying to say something?
I can't see me, and I can only see some of you. But anyway, as long as you can hear me, what I wanted to say about going back into the womb, that centering prayer expression, a newborn baby, mother's all its needs, without any plan, wonder. The best of it is, they have not learned yet to fear. I don't believe we can speak to prayer. And there's much to be afraid of these days, but if we can center ourselves, go back into that womb-like feeling, or even out of the womb, just somebody's tender arms around us. It doesn't matter whose arms, somebody's arms belonging to somebody who cares, then we won't have to be afraid.
Yeah. Thank you. Wonderful. I think that resonates with what, Dorothy Zella was saying in terms of, you know, this invitation to have this fearlessness while realizing that we're going to have constant difficulty, you know. And it reminded me also of when our first son was born, we printed these. They look like giant enlarged book pages, but one of them is a quote from Frederick Buechner that says, "Here is the world. Beautiful and terrible things will happen. Do not be afraid." Yeah. And how do we return to that place where we're unafraid? I wrestle with that daily, you know, like of battling fear and trying to detach from anxiety. And I do agree. I think centering prayer is one way that we start to learn. We need to come to know what that feels like, to let go of fear in order to do it well, you know? And we need to come to find a practice. I love that, you know, Marianne, what you were calling just silence, you know, like that we can find a place within our weekly rhythms to attune to that place, because it just takes some intentionality, you know, it takes a little bit of work, because it doesn't happen so naturally for us most of the time. So, thank
Tim,
you.
could I add on to that?
Absolutely.
I was sort of challenged. Brian McLaren came to our church recently.
Yeah.
And did a day's. It was beautiful, wonderful. And so I have something but to fall in love every day.
Mm-hmm.
So what I've been doing in my morning meditation is to just intentionally find something to fall in love with. First day it was a lizard. Today it's going to be Zoom, but I'm finding when I sit there, it's really a mindfulness practice of just looking at and being with the sensory elements, but then it moves very deeply into a heart-centered awareness, and I've been journaling with it too, and it's just been amazing to see the themes that have come out and the beauty, but what really has been happening to me is that every day after I've been in this heart-centered awareness, it's different than just the centering prayer. It's really an intentional connection with the beauty and the, and maybe not so much beauty of the world. And it carries throughout the day with me. And I can find attention to that practice. So it's a wonderful addition for Lenten rather than a subtraction.
Mm. Thank you.
Tim, it looks like it's getting near the end, and I don't want to stop the conversation, but I did want to ask if at the end you would do your blessing for all of us.
Did you say the blessing?
Yeah.
Oh, sure, absolutely. Yeah, whenever you all want to wrap up.
Not quite yet, but when we're through.
Yeah.
Trying to see how the system works. We're exploring along as well as listening, you know.
Right. It's all an adventure, isn't it?
Do you want to go over, Judith, what happens next with Word and Life, since this is the end of this part of the series?
All right. I have a little bit of news about May. I talked to Dave Rico this morning, and we're going to put it off decision-making for 2 weeks. And see whether or not we will have the physical, which I think it's kind of 70-30% we'll probably be doing Zoom. But Dave is going to need some instruction from Tim on how to be the Zoom master. because he doesn't know how to do that. He's going to do Zoom for his poetry class, but that comes through the City College pipeline. So that's a different vehicle for his poetry class. So it looks like it's going to be, Dave's book is Triggers, and it's going to be the fourth Thursdays in May, and most likely being Zoom. So it'll be $50, and that would include the book. So that's essentially what we talked about this morning. But maybe we'll be able to do it physically. I don't know. Okay?
Thank you.
Well, I'm done.
I think we're done.
Okay.
Hello. Tim is going to give us a blessing.
I'll say hello. I'm in the middle of watching one of my meetings.
Somebody's on the phone there. I can't tell who it is.
Yeah.
Carol. I don't know if I can hear me in the background or not.
We can't hear you.
Can't.
Hi, Carol. Well, here's what I'll do is I'll mute you all for a second so that we don't hear the phone, and then I'll give the blessing, and then I'll unmute you all, and we can say goodbye. Does that sound good?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. All right, so this is a blessing that we give to our community each week. You know, I've always I like to be creative. I'm always one to mix it up, but they keep saying you're not allowed to change it. So, you know, hopefully, you know, it'll work here for for our blessing too. So it goes like this. Bless the whole world, for we are all connected to one another. Say yes to your life's adventure, noticing and cultivating beauty as you go. Cover one another with a friendly presence, especially during these times. Learn to laugh with those who are joyful and cry with those in sorrow. Eat with anyone and everyone, always doing your best to ensure that those without have enough. And love with courage, for love is the only way forward. And you are loved. You are loved. You are deeply loved. Remember that there's grace and beauty in the becoming of your life, and yes, even in this season. And go in the name and peace of Christ. Amen.